Hi, everyone. This is Vanessa Firehead of the People Speak radio show. Here we believe when the people speak, we make a difference. Our show began simply enough. We decided that speaking out was far better than talking to each other. Tonight, our guest is a woman that is speaking out and making sustainable action and difference to create change in the world. Sarah Haynes is a creator, CEO, and founder of the Spitfire Agency, a company that tours with musicians, actors, and activists speaking out on global issues. After a four-year struggle with her own personal and professional life, Sarah sold OBE, Onboard Entertainment, and created a new agency solely to the responsible for the implementation of responsible businesses, nonprofits, and other cause-related ventures. That's what the Spitfire Agency is. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the People Speak.
Hi, Basama. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. Started in the entertainment field in an unusual split way, Sarah. You volunteered to answer phones at an alternative radio station?
Yeah, that's how I started. I was going to San Diego State University, kind of half going to San Diego State University, sort of in party mode in my first few years in college, and won a Plimsoll's record on 91X in San Diego, which is one of the first alternative radio stations out there. And I went down to pick it up, and the woman at the front desk was talking to somebody on the phone and really stressed about how there was nobody there to answer the phones. Apparently they were giving away $10,000 or $25,000 to the 91st caller at one point that day, and they had nobody to answer all the phones. And I said, well, I'll do it. And I proceeded to, you know, when the certain song came up, I proceeded to go, you're caller one, you're caller two, you're caller three, and yeah, ended up working there for quite a few years.
That's very interesting. So that was your drugstore entrance into the big world of glamour, huh?
Yeah.
That is so cool. Sarah, you made national promotion director at the age of 25 in a faction of the music industry, Relativity. That's
I
big.
Did. What's that?
That's big at 25.
Well, I think there's a little luck and a lot of hard work, but mostly some luck. I was working at 91X, and I'd risen up to the position where I was helping choose the music, and got a record called Thelonious Monster, and I don't know if you remember that record. The big hit at the time was the Sammy Hagar Weekend. And I believed in it and pushed for it, and we started playing it, and it blew up, and the record company took notice, and I developed a relationship with them, and at some point they offered me a job.
Actually, didn't you have, like, five number one hits at the time?
Oh, I had a number of number one hits at the company I went to. So once I went to Relativity Records, they really started blowing up, very much luck again. They had some really good bands signed, and I got there, and a few other people got there that were really strong with promotion and came from radio, and we were able to bring on a series of number one hits that really put that record company on the map.
And from there, you ended up becoming vice president of promotion?
I became vice president of promotion. It had an interesting circumstance. I was hired by a really kind, fabulous man who had some alcohol issues, and he had gone in and out of rehab a number of times. And every time he went into rehab, I had to take over. And, I entered into that company as an assistant, you know, making $17,000 a year. And but every time he had to leave, I took over, and I really learned a lot, and he began trusting me, and at one point he finally left permanently. It was just a little bit too much pressure for him in that situation, and they hired me to do the job, so I made vice president there. And then because of all those hits and because the company was doing so well, Sony took notice and bought us and moved me to New York and made me a vice president over there. So a lot of luck, you know, kind of fell into the right place.
Being the youngest VP in the industry is probably was a little bit of intimidating. How did you feel about that?
I actually had no idea. I got a call from a magazine. I didn't know, you know. I got a call from, I was really, I mean, truly, I was in over my head, and I was doing my best and able to survive. But, you know, I wasn't the best promotion director out there, for sure. They just believed in me, and I worked really hard, so I got through it. But the first, you know, few years were a little painful. But, I got a call from a trade magazine. I think it was the Album Network or the Hard Report. And they said, you know, you're the youngest VP in the music industry, VP of promotion in the music industry. And I was shocked. And then they said, do you know that you're the only female that's in that role as well? And
the only female and the youngest female.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, double whammy.
I was really surprised. I was really surprised. But, you know, shortly thereafter, some other people started getting in those roles. But I think, you know, I think female versus male really wasn't that big of a deal. It was more chance, but the youngest part was a pretty big deal for sure, because it was a tough job.
Well, I can imagine that it must have been, especially at that time. That was a pretty big time in music. How did you make the transition? You had a lot of alternative stuff going on, and Relativity was involved in a lot of the alternative music, wasn't that?
Yeah, they originally began importing records from Europe, and they imported a lot of really great alternative records. Robin Hitchcock, they brought in Metallica. I guess that wouldn't be considered alternative at the time. Yeah, they distributed Metallica. It's obviously not from another country, but they distributed Metallica, and they started getting radio play on that. And they said all sorts of really interesting artists, and in the alternative music field where people are always searching for new, different music, they were bringing in a lot of what people were adopting. So, yeah, they were doing that, and then they started signing their own bands. And actually what they really blew up with wasn't so much alternative. It was guitar rock. It was Joe Satriani and Steve Vai and Stu Hamm and artists like that.
Do you see a lot of cycles in the music industry? I mean, with all of the history and coming from where you came from, obviously you started right from the ground floor, winning an alternative record and going into the industry and then dealing with alternative music as a career. Do you find that there are cycles in this kind of music?
Yeah, a little bit. I think there's more cycles with the business folks. I think people have always been really open to lots of kinds of music. They just don't necessarily get it they don't find it on the airwaves or find it in the easy places to find it. But, Relativity, right, started alternative and then really broke doing guitar rock and then what they're most known for is hip-hop. So it really definitely changed. I went from Joe Satriani to Eazy-E and definitely they had a lot of rap records. It definitely changed, but it seems that all of those three forms of music I just mentioned are all still going strong.
Sarah, onboard entertainment was part of your life, and you did end up selling it out. When did you start going into the direction of progressive programs and humanitarian work? Was there a defining moment during the time that you owned Onboard? Or was that something that came after, or did it slowly come into your life?
Well, I started Onboard when I left Sony. I took a year off and traveled around the country. And then I started Onboard with a friend of mine. He had started it about a month before, and then I joined him. And that business, that company, was really focused on sports and music. It was pre-Warped Tour, pre-X Games, and we were doing those sorts of events. And I personally have always been an activist in all sorts of ways. I was a vegetarian since I was a little kid. I've always loved animals and am very focused on animal rights. I still am. I work with a number of nonprofit foundations and rescue organizations and things like that. So that was always a big one for me. And my mom has always, my mom runs, she runs orphanages in India and all sorts of stuff. So I was always exposed to that sort of thing. But I was really focused on the fun part of it in my earlier years of just sports and music and rock and roll shows. And as we were doing Onboard, I met Zach from Rage Against the Machine, just around standard music concerts, and he and some friends of his came to me and said, "Would you be willing? We have this idea, and would you be willing to help us make it happen?" And it was a tour of musicians, actors, and activists speaking out on global issues. At the time, they weren't really sure what it was going to be, but Zach was performing in Rage Against the Machine, and he felt like a lot of people were going to the concerts and having a great time and singing the lyrics, but not quite understanding where those lyrics were coming from. So, you know, they may be thinking it's a party anthem, like, well, I can't say the word, I don't think, on the radio, but F you, I won't do what you tell me.
Oh, please, you can say anything you want on this show.
Fuck you, I won't do what you tell me. That song, you know, people thought it was a big party song, and really it was, you know, about a Zapatista revolution. So he felt like he wasn't quite getting through on the message sometimes, but he didn't want to preach to people at concerts. And so he said, you know, let's create something else that's all about the content, the topic, and not so much about the music. And he and his friends came up with this idea, and they called me, and they had no name for it, and they didn't know how it would work, but they knew that I had packaged a lot of tours and concerts and things like that. We had worked on World's Fair and Ozfest in sponsorship roles, but lots of things like that, X Games, et cetera. And they came to us and said, can you help us make this into something a little bit more digestible and something we can get out there? And that's what became the Spitfire Tour. And that became musicians, actors, and activists speaking out on global issues. There'd be a few acoustic songs, but mostly it was going to college campuses and talking about the tough topics.
So none of this was really just kind of, you know, brand new to you. You've always been interested and inclined in these areas, but never had taken it to the next level.
I didn't know a lot about it, but yeah, to some degree. Like, for instance, when they called, my first phone call, I had just seen Woody Harrelson doing a video against Gillette, who was doing a lot of really horrific animal testing. So, you know, there was one topic that I totally related to. And I immediately got in contact with him. I didn't know him at all, but I found my way through that. And you know, asked him to be on the tour. And he said, sure, I'd love to, but I want to talk about hemp. And then I called, like, 10 other animal people, and they all said, sure, I'd love to, but right now I'm really focused on what's going on, you know, in Zimbabwe. So we ended up with all these topics on the tour. I never did get my animal rights activist topic until about 2 years later when we got big enough where I could put just plain activists on it, but it just evolved. And every time I went to one of the shows, to my own shows, I learned more and more about topics I didn't know about, because we had a rotating cast of folks on it. So, geez, we had probably about 50 different speakers, so I certainly couldn't know everything they were talking about, and I learned a lot about it. And the more I learned about it, the more I felt like I wanted to sell the company that I owned that produced it, but also produced a number of other events. We were that agency of record for Nike and their events. They still are the agency of record, and did all sorts of events with, you know, Taco Bell and things like that. And it just kind of slowly but surely felt like I've learned so much about all these companies and what they support, and I just didn't want to support any of them anymore, so I sold it.
You've done a lot of work with Daryl Hannah as well, haven't you?
I have, yeah.
Now, my favorite image of Daryl is when she was sitting in the trees
in L.A.
in the rainforest. That was pretty powerful.
In the rainforest? Where was this?
It seemed to me, I recall, that there was a time when she was actually sitting in the tree, and she was she had joined a group of people that would go up, climb into the trees, and live in the trees for a while. In the rainforests of different areas, so in order to make a statement that they weren't going to come down and they couldn't cut these trees down.
I didn't even know that, but I can tell you, and I'm wondering if it's she very well could have done that, it sounds like her, but she actually climbed a tree in downtown L.A. in Watts to protest a community farm being cut down, and that was just a few years ago.
From my understanding, she's done a lot of great stuff, which isn't surprising. I mean, we find the Hollywood community and the celebrity community is very involved. Do you find a lot of that to be authentic? I know that Woody Harrelson, just from the research that I've done on you and your work, and with Daryl Hannah. They seem to be truly genuine. Alicia Silverstone, too. And then, you know, your work with Julia Butterfly Hill. These people that have done a lot of this work, I think, too, are authentic. Do you find that to be pretty prevalent in the celebrity community?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't worked with anybody who I don't think is really authentic. I wouldn't work with them if I didn't. But I gotta tell you, just like any other activist, even as a celebrity, it's a bit of a fight. And, you know, nobody's going to go the distance for PR. Sooner or later, they're going to get tired and want to go home and, you know, eat bonbons and watch TV. So I think that most of the celebrities out there that are talking about issues are pretty committed. I mean, they're always at risk of, you know, their next film or whatever, you know, what have you. So if they're out there raising hell, so to speak, it's not always a good thing for their career. And
exactly,
usually,
and Woody's taking some risks, I think.
Woody's taking all the risks. He's taking every risk for all of us. He just
but
doesn't care.
I agree.
Know?
I think that's probably just the way he is. I mean, I can't see him doing it any other way.
Yeah, you know, he's the very first celebrity I worked with, and he was so much fun and is so much fun because, you know, he thinks for himself. He doesn't care what the repercussions are, other than the positive repercussions toward the Earth, which he cares very much about. And he's a lot of fun. He doesn't mind doing some pretty wild stuff. So, you know, he climbs the Golden Gate Bridge and protests the cutting of the redwoods up in the Bay Area. He's really a lot of fun, and he's not the guy that just wants to go to a press conference at, you know, the hotel. He's looking to get out there and really raise awareness through interesting avenues. So he's a lot of fun to work with, for sure.
Well, I just find it ludicrous still to this day in the year 2007 that there are people in the United States of America that actually risk their careers just by doing the right thing. I mean, that's just such an unusual reference of thought for us in America to be thinking, you know.
I don't know if they really are these days so much. I know that back in the early days, we had some sponsorship. I wish I could tell you which beer it was. I don't remember. He had a beer sponsorship, and he spoke out against some environmental injustices, and his publicist called him the next day and said they don't like it, and if you do it again, you lose the contract. And he lost the, you know, he immediately went straight out and did something because that's the way Woody is. He's like, oh, you don't like that? Okay, here we go again. And he lost the contract, and he was glad because he didn't want to ride in the float the next day anyway and be the beer king. So it all worked out fine in some parade he had to be in.
Kind of worked out to his favor.
Yeah, I think it was something big. It was the Rose Parade or whatever, you know. He was like King Budweiser or something. And he was thrilled that he was no longer involved.
Well, that certainly says a lot about her. Greening the Virgin. That sounds pretty seductive, if you ask me. Can you tell me about Greening the Virgin?
Are you talking about the Virgin Festival?
That's the comment that I had seen, and I just love the way they express that, Greening the Virgin. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, that sounds really hot.
I don't know if you're talking about the same thing as me.
We are. We're talking about the Virgin Festival put on by Virgin Mobile.
Woody might have greened the Virgin. I definitely did not green any Virgin.
Isn't that what you do, though?
Daryl and I greened the Virgin Festival.
You bring the green into these festivals. And,
yeah.
And like I said, when I heard that, I thought, oh, that's too funny. I have to mention that to her.
it at the Virgin Festival, it's a huge concert. It's nearly 100,000 people. It was just last week. We encourage people to find their G spot, their green spot, and to adopt new principles. It was a lot of fun. 100,000 people. Daryl Hannah really helped me with that one. She's friends with Richard Branson, who owns Virgin Mobile and Virgin Airlines.
He runs. Richard Branson runs the festivals, correct? The Virgin
Festival.
Well,
he owns them. He doesn't run them in terms of producing them, but he's certainly actively involved.
I see.
Yeah. And, you know, he owns the big, giant company, Virgin. Virgin Airlines, Virgin Mobile, Virgin all sorts of stuff, Cola, you name it. And Daryl had met him in the past and is friends with him, and she mentioned to him, you know, he's really an innovative guy. He's out there working in biofuels. He's, he offered up $25 million, I believe, dollars to the person who can invent a system to remove carbon from the atmosphere. He's really a great guy, and he's exploring ethanol and cellulose ethanol so that more crops don't have to be grown. That's a byproduct of the plants that are being grown in the first place. And just a really interesting, great guy. And Daryl said to him, "Hey, Richard, you care so much about the environment and about fuels. How about your concerts? You know, what about those being zero waste?" And he said, "That sounds great, Daryl. Let's do it." And literally within 24 hours, we were hired to do it. It was a painless hiring process. He just said, "Let's go," and their people called, and we did it. And that was about 4 or 5 months ago. We worked on it with the goal of zero waste. I mean, near zero waste. There's always going to be something there. But
explain to our listening audience what zero waste means in an event the size of the Virgin Festival, Sarah.
It means a lot of work.
I can imagine.
I mean, shooting
I can't imagine. Perhaps you can explain to us exactly what is involved in something like this.
Oh, sure. We don't say zero waste. We say near zero waste because there's absolutely no way that something's not going to arrive that's going to end up being trash. But for the Virgin Festival, we changed every single product. So starting with power, you know, we ran the entire festival off the grid. Everything was running on B99 biodiesel, which is 99% biodiesel, 1% diesel. And the only reason we did the 1% diesel is it eliminates a tax that changes the finances significantly. So we ran all of the stages, five different stages, and all the power and the light towers and everything on biodiesel. And we had solar stages also, and we had solar recharging stations for cell phones and all sorts of stuff. And then all sorts of really cool educational elements around power. Like you could get on a bicycle and ride the bicycle, a stationary bicycle, and ride it, and the power from turning the pedals would light compact fluorescent, and then it would light a regular light bulb. But, you know, the compact fluorescent would be on immediately, and you'd have to ride for, like, 20 minutes to get the other bulb to light. So it was a lot of fun. We did a lot of really great interactive fun stuff for people to learn about energy. And then, let's see, we changed over all the things that you would normally be handed at an event. We changed to sustainable eco-equivalents. So the cups that said Bud Light on them, were made out of bioplastic corn, and they were composted. And all the plates that would normally be made out of virgin trees were made out of sugar cane, which is a byproduct also of sugar cane. It's called bagasse. And, we changed everything. The straws, the coffee stirrers, every cup, every lid, to-go boxes, I mean, everything you could ever imagine was changed over to a compostable product, with the exception of water bottles, which were, of course, recyclable. So we did that, too. And we signed up a local compost farm called Chesterfield Farms in Baltimore, and they took all of the food and food service items afterward and grinded it up, and it's now all headed to a local community park.
Going back to recycling, you also had organic and vegan, vegetarian food during these events, didn't you?
There were options. To be perfectly honest with you, I think that's one place where we could have done better on that particular event. The event isn't a green event. It's a normal concert event where they came to us and asked us to green it, and that was one area that was really difficult to change because they'd already signed up all the food vendors and everything was done there. So what we did is we maximized the options available to people, and then got rid of all the waste products. But there's still plenty of hot dogs on a stick.
None of the veggie hot dogs that are running around.
Well, they did have those too, actually. They were great about supplying an option for everything, but it definitely wasn't a farmer's market, you know.
Well, Sarah, there are levels of green. What exactly are the levels of green that are available that are options? And at what level do you work within the different levels according to certain clients?
Well, you know, the way we say it is there's different shades of green, and there's a whole lot of people talking about a shade of green that's not so green at all. For me personally, for our agency, we really don't get involved in anything unless they're truly going for it. And there's going to be the occasional exception, like the food at Virgin Festival. I wouldn't give it an A-plus in being green. It was certainly great food and everybody was happy, but it just wasn't as green as it could be. Every other element I do give them an A-plus on. But, you know, I don't like to get involved in events that are kind of half doing something. So when people call and they say, oh, we just want a little bit of help in this one little area, you know, they're going to end up putting it in the press and everything. So I generally don't get involved, or I just give them information on how to do it themselves and let them start their path. But in order for us to get behind it, especially with our celebrities, you know, power and that, you know, press element and all of that, we don't want to do that unless they're really committed to doing everything. And it's, you know, the solutions exist. It's really not that hard. If somebody's committed to doing it, they can. And they can do it perfectly. And, you know, it's not hard to green an event these days. Biodiesel is everywhere. You know, compostable products are everywhere. It's certainly logistically difficult. It's a lot of work and a lot of time. But, you know, we're not going to the moon here. This is definitely something we can all handle.
Well, our board producer really wants to know, are you involved in Greening the Man event next week?
You know, I am. I'm surprised you caught on to that one because it's not all that well publicized. But, yeah, I'm a 13-year burner. I'm a big fan of Burning Man. I love it. It's the time of my year. It's my favorite time of year. And about 5 years ago, I went into their offices and met with them and said, you know, I really love... I actually brought Julia Butterfly with me one year, about 5 years ago, and she loved the event but was, you know, distraught over all the waste and the burning of wood and all of that. And she and I talked about it, and I said, well, I don't think it... She said, I'm not going to go again. And I said, what about convincing them to do it differently? She said, Julia doesn't believe in a lost cause, but I don't think that was one that was looking like it was going to be happening anytime soon. And so I'm really committed to going to the event. It's something I truly love. It's an art event. It's amazing. And so I went in there and met with them, and I told them that, you know, I'd like to help them transition into being somewhat more green. And they really weren't interested. There were one or two people that thought it was a fabulous idea. And then, I mean, I had a board member tell me to get my green shit away from her. So it was definitely a tough sell back then. But we did a few years later because of the help of the guy who runs Recycle Camp, Lou, and a woman who does all their photography, Camera Girl, who really cared about making it green. We were able to slowly but surely infiltrate the system. And the first year we switched all the commissary products to eco products, like I just mentioned, we had at Virgin, and all the cafe products. So most people don't know it, but Burning Man actually serves thousands of meals in a commissary for the staff, and the staff is out there for a month. And there's a lot of people out there working on that event. So we changed over all of those disposable items, and we changed the toilet paper to 100% post-consumer waste, and changed all sorts of little things. We ran a few generators, biodiesel as a test, and slowly but surely just sort of infiltrated the system for the last few years. And while I have nothing to do with the theme, the Green Man, I was as surprised as anybody. I was really happy to see it. I think we really did change opinions within for the board members and for the people making those decisions. And now they're going for it, and it's exciting, and I don't really have to do very much because Burning Man is one of those events where somehow people who haven't done things in the past are able to really take them and run with them and do an incredible job. I've seen it. You know, Burning Man isn't run by producers, but they produce one of the best events out there.
Well, it seems to me that the U.S. in general is really attaching to the green life. And I think that, like you said, it's going to be a lot less difficult to sell a lot of this stuff to people out there today.
Yeah.
You have a good friend, and you've mentioned her on the show already, Julia Butterfly Hill, of the Circle of Life. She sounds like a pretty interesting person. She asked you to do something for 1 week. Can you tell our audience about that?
I can. The Ultimate Julia Challenge, and I challenge all of you to do it. It is so much fun. One of my favorite things about Julia is she makes learning and changing your ways fun always. She never wants it to be painful. So it was a little painful, but it was painful in a really fun way. She challenged me to carry my own trash for a week. And boy, do you realize where you can cut back that you don't even think about until you carry your trash for your own trash for a week. So, for instance, I already carried my own coffee mug to the coffee shop every day, so I didn't have to take a cup. But when you're carrying your own trash for a week, you really think about having, you know, do you want the little tiny fancy feast cat foods for your cat, or you get the bulk can, put it in the fridge, and reuse it every day? You know, if you go to a bar, do you get a bottled beer, or do you get a beer on tap? There's so many ways to save products, and when you're having to lug around all the beers you drank the night before in a backpack that's stinky and clinking, you really realize how many you're carrying around versus, you know, putting it on tap.
Well, you know, that's just an amazing concept. Here I'm sitting there listening to you, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, if I had to carry all my trash around for a week, I don't know what I'd do.
And there's
that
so many
big,
things you
really
don't even think of, like the oil in your car and, you know, there's so many things, wrappers, and, you know, you'd get a package as a business. You know, I get packages in the mail with tons of bubble wrap. So what do I do with the bubble wrap? That counts. I have to shove it. I had a European travel backpack, like the giant backpacks that fit sleeping bags and everything, the first week. But what I did is I learned so many tricks to the trade that about maybe a month or two later, I tried it again, and I did the whole thing with the school backpack.
Just amazing.
It's a lot of fun to try to do.
I like I said, it's just when I read about that, I thought, what an interesting concept.
Yeah, it's
you've
up
you've
an
got
amazing
a lot of innovative. I'd like to take this into another direction for just a minute. You've got a lot of innovative links on your site that take ordinary purchases and donate to causes such as Civic, which is a campaign for innocent victims of conflict. And these are victims of war around the world. You went to with a number of people, one of which was Joan Baez, to Afghanistan. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and how that came about?
I did go to Afghanistan. Joan Baez wasn't on my trip. I'm not sure. She may have been.
Oh,
on
I'm sorry.
One.
I thought it was Joan Baez.
Bianca Jagger was there. Maybe that's what
I'm sorry. You're right. Bianca Jagger.
Yeah. But I have worked with Joan, and she's amazing, too. And I'm sure she would have gone. When the war in Afghanistan started, I was obviously troubled like many of us. And I was talking to a woman who runs Global Exchange. Her name's Medea Benjamin, an amazing peace activist. And she told me that she was going to take a small group of women into Afghanistan on the first United Nations plane to do an assessment of what was going on and then to reach out in the press and in the, to the public to get help for the areas that needed it. And I never thought for a second I would be on that list, but I said, wow, that sounds so amazing. If somebody were ever to drop out at the last minute, let me know. And she ended up calling me a few weeks later. This was right at the fall of Kabul. She ended up calling me a few weeks later, and she said, I've got a slot. Do you want to go? You have to get all your shots within 48 hours. You have to fly down to L.A. and get your, you know, special passports and visas for this. You know, it's obviously an area they weren't letting Americans go into and tourists go into. And I did it. I hustled, and I stopped everything I was doing, and I was very lucky to be taken out on a U.N. plane to Kabul and live there for a few weeks and be a part of starting microloan programs for women and touring, you know, the various refugee camps and giving information out when we got home about that. It was amazing. The best part of the whole thing, though, I must say, looking back on it now, is that I...
Did you actually get back with an organization?
It was with Global Exchange.
I see.
Yeah, which is a nonprofit here in San Francisco dedicated to peace. The best part of that trip, though, you know, I met Bianca Jagger there. She was my roommate. I had so much fun. It was a really amazing trip, and it was also incredibly difficult. You know, it wasn't all fun. But one of the most amazing things that happened there is that I spent a lot of time with a woman named Marla Ruzica, who owns the Campaign for Innocent Civilian Victims, or she did own it. She was killed in Iraq a year or two later by a car bomb. A really amazing woman who I look back at that trip now, and I feel like it was, I knew her before, and she was a friend of mine before, but that trip really solidified our friendship as, you know, best friends and close, you know, one of each other's best friends. And it was such an amazing time. And she's just, boy, if your show's about ordinary people doing extraordinary things, I wish you could interview her.
What did you bring back with you after your visit to Afghanistan?
Well, just
emotionally, what did you bring back with you?
What's that?
Emotionally, what did you bring back with you from Afghanistan?
I was actually really surprised at how open the people were there to our bombing of their area. I thought that they would hate Americans, and while very displaced and distraught, and many of the people I met were in hospitals, they were victims of cluster bombs and accidental bombing where they, you know, were aiming for a certain target and ended up getting innocent civilians. The people were incredibly kind, and they wanted help. I was really surprised. They wanted help, and they weren't... much as I don't want to say this in some ways because my own opinions are involved in that, but I don't think they were so adverse to the military help. I think their biggest concern was having much more responsible decisions around it, and, you know, there shouldn't be cluster bombs dropped in a community, in a city. I mean, those things spread out over you know, many football fields, and there's just no way of doing something like that and not hitting all sorts of innocent people. So those were their major concerns. So I came back feeling that they were incredibly understanding and loving and kind, and they just wanted us to be a little more careful.
Yeah, I would imagine. Being careful with bombs, I mean, they call them smart bombs, but I think they're really pretty dumb.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I personally don't believe in, you know, what was going on there at all, but you know, that's what I brought back from them.
For those of you that are interested, we are speaking with... And in speaking with our guest today, Sarah Haynes, you can call toll-free internationally at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. I believe we have a caller right now on the phone, Mike from California. Mike, do you have a question for Sarah?
Hi. Hi to you and your guest. I was going to ask your guest, are there any bands in particular in the United States that are green-friendly? That, you know, they specifically ask if the concerts or festivals that they attend will be greened. And is this just a national United States thing, or do you do this internationally as well? Thank you.
Yeah, there are a number of bands that are starting to do that. It's for the larger bands, it's a pretty tough request because... they play in national clear channel venues that are not yet green, or they're starting to do a little bit of that, but they're sort of stuck within the system, and they're so big that they can't play anywhere but these big venues, these big cow palaces and sheds, which are amphitheaters. So they do what they can. A lot of times it's backstage in their own area, or it's with their own bus running biodiesel, et cetera. It's really tough for them to change the system outside front of house where all the kids are. The smaller bands are able to do a lot. In fact, I just got an email today from Adam Gardner, who is in Guster, and has a company very similar to mine, greening tours and such, mostly biodiesel bus tours, called Reverb, and they're doing a lot in that area. The Red Hot Chili Peppers have done a lot. They haven't been able to change the big venues, as I mentioned, but they do a lot on their own. They were the first band to use tree-free paper on a record. They produced their entire record. It's called, by the way, Tree Free. So, yeah, bands are doing a lot. I think it's going to change over the next year. I think that these large venues owned by, you know, one or two corporations across America are going to have to change because the bands are really demanding it, and it's just so uncool not to do it.
How many people do you have working with you when you arrange this kind of event?
It depends on the event. For the Virgin Festival, which we did, which is just did, and which is one of the biggest events out there, like I said, it was just under 100,000 people over 2 days. We had about 250 people. The bulk of them volunteers, but 200 of them volunteers and about 50 on payroll.
Very interesting. You wrote a mission statement, Sarah, on a plane ride. Can you tell us what you wrote about?
Oh, that's funny. You do good research. Well, a man asked me, I was just sitting on the plane, and a man said, so what's your mission? And I proceeded to, you know, this is back when I worked at Onboard, spout off my company mission, you know, we're a full-service production and marketing agency. And he was like, no, your mission in life, why are you here? What's your goal? Like, what are you trying to do? And I said, God, I haven't really thought of it like that. Give me the plane ride, and I'll have one for you when I'm done. And so I worked on a few different drafts on the plane, and I came up with something pretty simple, to have minimum impact on the planet and maximum impact on its people. And that's the focus of my agency today, compliments of a man whose name I do not know.
Well, that may be simple, but it's a very profound statement, I often wonder, if we had mission statements in our lives, how would our lives take us in different directions? Do you have a spiritual context for your work, Sarah?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, for me, like, I've never been religious, but for me, nature to me is God, so I suppose I'm worshiping God every day in what we're doing. You know, I guess that's about as far as I can go with that question.
You know, as a healer, many times we are told that we have to live that which we wish to see manifest. Do you live green?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I definitely have moments where I say, oh, it's too hard, and I do something that I wished I hadn't or probably shouldn't. But, yeah, I definitely live green. My home is as green as it can be in the shade. Unfortunately, I can't do solar here. But I have a little Airstream trailer I take around the country, and it runs off the grid, and drive a hybrid car and carry my own cup. But, you know, all the things we've talked about. Yeah, I'm definitely living green. But there's elements where I'm not. You know, like I said, I drive a hybrid car, but I also have an Isuzu Trooper that I drive very seldom. But when I have airport runs, my hybrid car is a two-seater. When I have airport runs or I'm hauling a trailer to an event, I'm driving that big Isuzu Trooper hauling with the regular gas. I'm really looking forward to the Jeep Grand Cherokee coming out diesel this year, and I am immediately going to get it and run it biodiesel.
You know, my producer and I were talking earlier in the day about the interview, and he made mention of the fact that you live in Mill Valley. One of our previous guests, Mark Watts, he was the son of the famous philosopher Alan Watts. Joan Baez lives in, and that's where I got the name. I was, for whatever reason, I was thinking of Joan Baez when I was, instead of Bianca. And what is it about that area? Is there that seems to be attractive to very very to people that are very involved in what is going on Earth today?
Yeah, Marin is incredibly aware county. I'm so lucky to be here. I think in part it's near a hip city, and it's really close. You know, it's only a couple exits away. It takes me 10, 15 minutes to get to the marina. Yet it is smack in the middle of some of the most gorgeous old-growth redwoods in the world. So it's a really just lovely place to be if you don't want to be completely out in nature and unable to go anywhere, but also want to be surrounded by the trees and the nature. So I think that's part of it, the history here. The Grateful Dead was here. Bonnie Raitt lives in this area. My house that I'm sitting in right now while I'm talking to you, it used to be Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac's place.
Oh, wow.
Old artist compound. It's a crazy place. It's going to sound really ritzy, and it's not. It's like old and funky, but it's got two guest houses and an indoor pool, and it's just funky. Like, Lady invented rebirthing, built this indoor pool, a heated warm pool. I don't use it for rebirthing. I just use it for fun parties. But there's some really funky characters that came from this area, not just my home. I mean, every home in Mill Valley has had some interesting person living there at one point or another.
Yeah, it was interesting when you said that. I thought, wow, there must be something there must be a beautifully attractive force in that area to attract that kind of rich element and human quality.
Mount Tam and Muir Woods, those are two of the biggest. Just amazing, amazing. You asked about spirituality. I mean, just spiritually gorgeous places.
What are you most proud of in your life, Sarah?
It's so funny, those questions you should know, and I really don't know. Geez, I wish I had a whole plane ride to come up with this one. I think my friendships. I think that I'm most proud of being a loyal friend. I think I make lots of mistakes in this world, but one thing I don't think any of my friends would ever accuse me of is not being always there for them and very, very loyal and committed. So I guess I'm most proud of that.
You know, here on the People's, we try to make a point of helping to be part of the solution and not the problem. Do you have any advice on how people can get involved in making a difference?
Sure. Find what you love and do it like crazy. Right? Have fun. Like, I think you got to find the thing you love. Like, honestly, if I was, mucking around in a river pulling out old refrigerators, I might be really miserable. And I think that's a really beautiful job and a wonderful project, and there's lots of people that would love it. I'd love it for a weekend, and a month later, I'd hate it. And, I think you've got to find what you personally love. I've always loved entertainment. I've always loved music. I've started my career by calling a radio station, because I was like one of those crazy fans, and so I guess do what you love and you'll certainly do it well.
And do it like crazy. I like that. I like that a lot. The Spitfire Web calls it redefining cool. How does one redefine cool?
The Spitfire Web has a small little R in the corner of that, too, which means it's trademarked, but not by me. It's trademarked by the Circle of Life Foundation. It's Julia Butterfly's quote.
I see.
Redefining cool. You can redefine cool all sorts of ways. When Julia came up with that quote, which I borrowed from her in my website, she was saying, she really wanted to make sustainability and consciousness something that was hip and fun and cool to do instead of like kind of the crunchy foo-foo hippie new ager stuff, as she calls it. She wanted it to be professional and, like I said before, being green doesn't have to mean that you're less of an event, which is why things like the Virgin Festival are so great when they do it. It doesn't have to be more difficult. It doesn't have to be a process or a stage that stops functioning or whatever. So I think making things hip and cool means making them fun and interesting and exciting, like the bicycle that makes the light bulbs power, and also you know, passionate and exciting. And we're trying to take the aspects in life, be they celebrity or an event or concert, whatever, that people pay attention to, and using those to model solutions so that people get to see new ways of doing things in a hip, fun, cool environment. Does that make sense?
Of course it makes sense. It makes perfect sense, actually. How do you choose your path and the directions that you go? Do you base it on instinct, or do you base it more on intuition? What part of your inner self do you rely on the most?
Which one of those is when you don't think about it at all? Honestly, I couldn't even answer that.
Well, I don't know. I think it's instinct that that leads you to do the thing that's natural, but intuition, I think, is the one that keeps pushing from the inside out, telling you, hey, think about what you're doing here. So I'm not sure.
You know,
that's an interesting question. I guess I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, I probably am not nearly as strategic as I ought to be. I could probably do a lot more for myself in this world if I was. I've worked for big companies. I've done the, you know, drill, and now I just want to do whatever I love. So if something gets boring, I do something different. I don't have probably a very good business plan. I give away the information, like what would normally be proprietary information. If Intel develops a new chip, they're not going to put out all the information on how to develop one. But when we figure out how to green an event, we immediately put out every step-by-step guide you could find. You know, I just do what I love and do things that are different and like to prove that things can be. We were talking earlier about personality types, and I'm the challenger. I'm the 8 on the Enneagram, and I like a challenge, and I like to prove that something can be done. And once I've proven it, as long as I disseminate the information, I figure I might as well move on to something else.
And where do you think you're going to move on to next?
I really don't know. There is a film coming out on Julia that is still in its process, but looks to be a film coming out on Julia, a documentary, sort of an Aaron Brockovich-style film. And as soon as that is completely green-lighted, I believe I will be greening the first film in Hollywood, which will be really fun.
Before we're wrapping up in just a second, I'd like to ask you, Sarah, if you could change one thing in the world as a organizer of change, what would be the most important thing that you think you would like to change?
Wow, these are tough questions.
Sorry, I won't do it again.
I want to come up with a good one here, but if I could change any one thing.
Just one thing.
I guess I would. I don't know. I think it's all so perfect just the way it is. It's like a board game to me, you know. Even all the problems, of which there are so many of, to me, I feel like I'm in a little board game. I'm always like trying to pass go and, you know, navigate.
That's very interesting for an 8, actually, in the Enneagram.
Well, it's a challenge, you know. I kind of feel like it's all just the way it's supposed to be sometimes, and then I also have this theory that everything's all messed up, so I never know for sure. But I guess if I was to be able to change anything, I would just give more power to the people, because then they could change everything, and I wouldn't have to do any of it.
Thank you. That's a fitting end to the People Speak radio show. Give more power to the people. Thank you, Sarah, for being with us. Ladies and gentlemen, it has just been an honor to have this young woman with us. We are, next week, our guest is going to be our new Gandhi, who is the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. We're very excited about that. Sarah, we hope you can join us again one day. We would love to keep tabs on your green work. Obviously, that's very important to our show. And thank you very much for being here, everyone. And, Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
You have a good evening.
Okay.
Bye-bye, folks. That's a wrap.
This land is mine, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. Walking that ribbon of highway, I saw love made that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said this land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts, and all around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. There was a high wall there that tried to stop me, and there was a sign that said, it said private property. But on the other side, it didn't say nothing. Oh, well, that sign was made for you and me. And the sun came shining when I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, and a voice was chanting that the fog was lifting. Yeah, this land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall, by the relief on the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering, yeah, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.